everything is ready for the show. Let's go.
And good evening and welcome to this week's edition of Musical Theatre Melodies, a program which comes to you over the airwaves of 96.5 Inner FM every Tuesday evening between the hours of 9 and 11 p.m., hosted by yours truly, Rob Morrison. And welcome too to any international or interstate listeners we may have listening in via the World Wide Web. Well, tonight's featured musical is Goodbye, Mr. Chips, which had music and lyrics by Leslie Bricus, and we shall be listening to the 1982 Chichester Festival cast recording, starring the one and only John Mills in the title role. But waiting online in the south of France, it's my very great pleasure to welcome back to the program the Oscar, Grammy, Ivor Novello award-winning composer, lyricist, screenwriter and librettist Leslie Bricus. Good afternoon,
hey,
Leslie.
Rob, lovely to hear you again.
And it's great to speak with you again too. Well, I guess the starting point for the stage version of Goodbye, Mr. Chips was the film version, which dates from 1969, and indeed an MGM musical too. And that followed on from Dr. Dolittle and reunited you with some of the personnel from the earlier film, including the producer Arthur P. Jacobs and also Herbert Ross, who made his directorial debut on the film. But apparently, as with Dolittle, you weren't the first choice for the composer and lyricist of Chips, and I read that some 51 songs had already been written for the film before it was decided that they weren't suitable and you were called in to take over.
Arthur Jacobs, the producer, brought out a commemorative album, a triple LP, called The Losers Sing Goodbye, Mr. Chips. Here are these 51 forgettable songs. Then they were written by, some of the ones of mine we didn't use, but also Andre and Dori Previn's songs were on it, and they were beautiful songs, but the English language was a bit of a problem there because there's a particular phrasing of the English language which didn't quite work in the lyrics. Which is why Arthur Jacobs came to me. Herb Ross and I were great pals of Andre and Dori, mm-hmm. and we offered to, you know, just chip in and fix things for them, but they didn't want to do that to MGM, so we had to start again.
Yes, yes. And I noticed amongst the people considered for the role of Mr. Chips were Laurence Olivier. Well, he could sing. He did so in the film version of The Beggar's Opera, in fact, and others included the gentleman, of course, who sang in Camelot,
Richard Burton,
indeed, yeah.
Oh, well, they had every... On the credits, on the forgettable songs, were Richard Burton, every name actor you could think of, and every name actress from Julie Andrews, Barbara Streisand, all sorts of ridiculous names. Mm-hmm. But anyway, we came down to having Peter O'Toole, one of the world's great non-singers, and Petula Clark played Mrs. Chips, which helped to make up for it.
Indeed, yes.
Peter was wonderful. He got nominated for an Oscar in the role.
Mm-hmm.
He was a wonderful actor. I remember writing, if the actor is Everest, the singer is Harrow on the Hill. In other words, his singing was not quite up to his acting, but mercifully we had John Williams as musical director of the film, and he made it work as well as it possibly could, mm-hmm. with Peter. He wasn't meant to do a musical, and yet the next film he did after this was Man of La Mancha, so figure that out.
Indeed, but of course his vocals were dubbed in Man of La Mancha. Did you consider having his singing dubbed in Mr. Chips at any stage?
No, he recorded in the normal way, and he wasn't Rex Harrison, who could do that better than anybody, but he was pretty good, and he was lovely in the film. His performance was wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
You don't get an Oscar nomination for nothing, you know.
No. And I read that John Williams actually had to take him, well, up to 49 times through the songs before he got a sound take that he considered was reasonably musical and in tune.
Oh, yes. At times we didn't see John for months. So we assumed he was with Peter.
And I guess it utilised the standard practice of having the singing vocals recorded beforehand and having the actors miming to them on set.
Yes, I mean, you know, eventually it's very difficult, you know. That's why Rex Harrison, as I said last week when we talked about his way of doing it, he recorded live on the stage. He didn't he didn't pre-record and do it to playback, which was the norm, because he was acting more than singing, and that's why it worked for him.
Mm-hmm.
But Peter wasn't quite as experienced. Rex had done 5 years in My Fair Lady though, by then, and so he'd mastered the art.
Mm. Indeed, yes, down to a fine art. And, of course, he had the distinguished playwright Terence Rattigan, who wrote the screenplay for this film version of Goodbye, Mr. Chips. And, of course, it's based on the novel by James Hilton, but Rattigan's version is more of an adaptation, as there are quite a few elements in the 1969 film that weren't in Hilton's original story, including updating the time period of the story and making the female lead a musical comedy actress of the period.
Yes, well, obviously that was to accommodate the fact that it was a musical. Pat Clark did one big production number on the stage in the film called London is London.
Mm-hmm.
And Terence Rattigan, he was a divine human being. He was one of the most wonderfully civilized men. And I knew him very well for about 6 years while he was, because he was working on that film when I arrived in Hollywood to do Dr. Doolittle. He was working on Goodbye, Mr. Chips.
All right.
And after Doolittle was over, 3 years later, he was still on Goodbye, Mr. Chips. And I said, are you still writing Goodbye, Mr. Chips? He said, yes, I can't stop.
So in some archive somewhere, there are 20-odd variations of Terence Rattigan's
scripts. Oh, God, there must be enormous number. He lived in where did he live? Bermuda, mm-hmm. Terry Rattigan. And he was known by, he was a great friend of Rex Harrison's as well, because he and Rex had started their life together on a play of Terry's called, what's it called?
Oh, French Without Tears?
French Without Tears, thank you. Mm-hmm. I was singing The French Connection. It certainly wasn't that. French Without Tears, that was in 1935, I think, and they'd remained friends ever since.
Mm-hmm.
And Terry had more wonderful stories about Rex than anyone I ever met. He delighted in telling them to.
And, of course, he was known for the play The Browning Version, which is another play about a schoolmaster and, indeed, another teacher of the classics.
Oh, yes. I mean, Terry's list of credits was mind-boggling. He had, I think he was as good a playwright as we had of his generation. And his plays are still performed, you know, and a lot of the films he wrote are still performed.
Mm.
So he was a giant of the industry, certainly.
Indeed, yes. I had the pleasure of seeing Paul Eddington play in the Browning version out here with the Harlequinade, so a double bill of the Terence Rattigan plays.
Right, yes, indeed.
20-odd years ago. And how did you go about the task of adding appropriate songs into his screenplay? I guess you had to read through the screenplay and decide on the moments that you think deserved musicalizing.
Well, yes, there were obvious key moments. Herb Ross was his first job as a director. He'd been our choreographer on Dr. Doolittle,
mm-hmm.
and he was ready to go into direction by then. And he also... He directed the musical numbers in Funny Girl with Barbara Streisand.
Oh, okay.
That wonderful sequence with the song Don't Rain on My Parade,
mm-hmm.
where she's on a boat in New York Harbor.
Oh, that's all right, dude.
It's absolutely brilliant, and that was the proof that Herb was meant to be a director, and he directed many, many wonderful films after that. The Sunshine Boys he did brilliantly, and he did two or three Woody Allen pictures. And he had a very good career as a director.
Mm-hmm, indeed. And an interesting feature of your score for the film is that many of the songs aren't production numbers as such, but are virtually internal monologues or soliloquies by the main two characters of Chips and Catherine.
Yes, that's where John Williams was a great help to me, because we had a lot of individual pieces where the actors expressed their thoughts within themselves, as it were, not in public. And there were lots of big production numbers as well, because obviously the school song, you know, which was all the boys of Brookfield School,
mm-hmm.
Holding forth, the school song was very effective. And they also sang songs, you know, like one was called When I Am Older, about when they grew up. But the main thrust of the film was the solo songs by Peter O'Toole and Pat Clark.
Mm-hmm, indeed. And of course, you noted before that London is London, the song that Petula Clark sang in the 1920s stage musical comedy sequence, you reused in your stage musical Sherlock Holmes about 20 years later.
Yes, because you see, it was originally written for Sherlock Holmes. It was already written when Goodbye, Mr. Chips came along.
Okay.
And Herb Ross knew about it and said, this is absolutely perfect. So on condition that I could have it back for Sherlock Holmes, I let it go out for Goodbye, Mr. Chips. And they let me have it back again afterwards.
Ah, great.
It's still, we have a new production of Sherlock Holmes next February in England, and it's right there where it belongs.
Indeed. Yes, I recall you saying that at one stage even Rex Harrison was being considered to star as Sherlock Holmes, so the mind boggles as to how he would have handled the role.
Well, I think he'd have been rather good. Sherlock Holmes had a waspish quality, and also, if you think about it, Holmes and Watson are really Higgins and Pickering. They're the same people from My Fair Lady.
Uh-huh.
You could transform them from one show to the other, and they'd be exactly the same people. And in fact, in my Sherlock Holmes, those songs of Sherlock Holmes would fit My Fair Lady if the context were different. Because they're both Indian Army doctors.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Both the men are misogynists, Holmes and Higgins. And both the other two are retired Indian Army doctors from the Army.
Yes, yes, indeed.
So one must have affected the other. I don't know who came first. I guess it would have been Sherlock Holmes came first, didn't it?
Yes, yes, because I think Pygmalion dates back to 1911, and ironically was performed in Germany before it was performed in London too. So.
Oh, I've had that sort of thing happen to me too.
But returning to the film version of Goodbye, Mr. Chips, I note that it used about 250 of the actual students from Sherborne College where it was filmed.
It's a beautiful school down in Dorset in England, and we were on location there quite a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a beautiful place, lovely place for kids to go to school.
And at the right period, too, to fit in with the story.
Exactly. Perfectly.
And ironically, I believe that John William Soul's stage score was written for the West End musical Thomas and the King about Thomas Becket and Henry II. It was a bit of a flop, so he's never returned to stage musicals since.
I saw Thomas and the King. It was at Her Majesty's Theatre, and it was Thomas Becket, and it was a rather good evening. I was surprised it didn't do better than it did, but John said he will never venture into the musical theatre again. Not that he had to, because he was offered every film on the planet.
Yes.
And it was interesting that last week on television here, there was a broadcast, BBC broadcast, it was one of the promenade concerts from the Albert Hall, on the music of John Williams. And the only piece of music in the programme not by John Williams was the overture of Goodbye, Mr. Chips. And the reason is it showed how his orchestral style developed during Chips, and he kind of became John Williams immediately after that.
Mm-hmm.
He went on to do and won his first Oscar for Fiddler on the Roof, which was just after Chips. And you can hear in the overture to Chips, and indeed all the way through, the orchestrations are just wonderful. He made me sound pretty good. His orchestral style is just like none other, and he's absolutely wonderful, and we were so lucky to have him.
Indeed, yes. Well, I remember seeing Star Wars the first time round when it was in the cinemas in the 70s, and everyone commented about that grand orchestral sweeping sound and sort of conjure up all the derring-do adventures.
Well, George Lucas said, quite recently, he said, I was very worried about Star Wars. It was so far out, I didn't know if it would work or not. And then I heard John's score before he did it properly, before he fitted it to the film. And he said, I just practically cried because I knew that the music was going to make it work. And then that's how it all came together.
Mm-hmm.
John has been the making of many great pictures that probably wouldn't have been great pictures without his contribution to them.
Yes, yes. And you've written that many songs together, and I noticed a bit of trivia that you actually wrote lyrics to a Christmas carol sung by the ghosts in one of the Harry Potter films to John Williams' music.
Oh, yes, that song was actually written for Hook.
Oh, okay.
We wrote a complete song score for Hook, and Steven Spielberg's, the film that he directed, became longer than the film had been intended to be, and of course when the film's too long, the first thing to go are the songs.
Mm-hmm.
But we wrote a full song score of 10 or 11 songs for that, And there are only, I think, three or four in the picture.
Oh.
And another theme that we didn't use for a song called Believe became something else at Hogwarts in Harry Potter.
Oh. So he has the mythical composer's trunk that he puts these things away in and brings out at appropriate moments, obviously.
Well, he doesn't need to do that because he's so fabulously talented, but on that one he just thought it was absolutely right, and at least it was a salvage job on one of the melodies, you know, one of the better ones too.
Indeed. Well, later in the evening we'll have a chance to listen to some of the songs from the soundtrack album of the 1969 film, which also includes the song When I Was Younger, which, although on the album was actually cut from the film itself, were there many songs that were written specifically for the film that didn't make the final cut?
Yes, in particular, Mrs. Chips's Ballad. I wrote 18 songs for this. I'd written everything for the film. I had this one left to do, the ballad, and I wrote a couple of songs every week through the summer of 68, and we couldn't get quite what I wanted. And then what happened was MGM, because the film was about to start shooting, as always with studios, brought in another writer.
Uh-huh.
And he was a man who was, God, I can't even remember his name. He was America's favorite poet. He was America's Rod someone.
Oh, Rod McEwen?
Rod McEwen, that's who he was.
Mm-hmm.
And an awful thing happened. He was asked to write this one song, and in one weekend he wrote 10 songs of such horror that he got rid of himself without me having to help.
Oh,
I was so angry that on the Monday morning I got the song that I was looking for, which was called You and I, which Pet Clark sang beautifully. And in fact, I wrote two songs.
Mm-hmm.
And John did orchestrations for them both, John Williams, and we recorded them both. And I'm not sure that the other one, which was called Tomorrow With Me, wasn't better. Certainly it was a better orchestration, and they were both pretty good. But You and I ended up in the film. I thought it would be more spectacular, but it was just Pet sitting on a staircase, warbling away. Anyway, we got rid of Mr. Rod McEwen.
Yes, well, I suppose you were driven to it through circumstances. And
yes, it was based on anger.
And of course, You and I are still in Petula Clark's repertoire too, as well as many other singers.
Yes, Pet sings it, Shirley Bassey sang it, and a lot of ladies have sung it since, so that's nice.
So the royalties keep coming in all through your anger.
Well, who knows?
Well, I guess we now segue into the stage version of Goodbye, Mr. Chips, and I believe that it was Patrick Garland, who was then the artistic director of the Chichester Festival, who came up with the idea of adapting it as a stage musical.
Well, it wasn't Patrick's idea, because we had talked about it for quite a long time, and Bernard Delfont, who was the producer of My Young Life, was rather keen on it, and Patrick offered to direct it at Chichester, which was a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it was a sellout because John Mills, John was meant to be the headmaster. He'd been in the first Goodbye, Mr. Chips film, for which
Robert
Donat won the Academy Award.
Mm-hmm.
And he won it, by the way, in the year that Clark Gable was in Gone with the Wind. And they were both MGM films, and Robert Donat won the Oscar over Clark Gable for Gone with the Wind.
Yes,
it's amazing, isn't it? When you look at the two films now. Anyway, Johnny Mills had been in that film as a young student called Collie.
Yep.
In 1938 or 9, and he had wanted to be in the film, but that part went to Michael Redgrave. I can't remember whether it was a conflict of schedules or what, but Johnny, who was a great pal of mine, he, Evie and I became the junior members of a little club which involved John Mills and Mary, his wife, Richard Attenborough and Sheila, his wife, Brian Forbes and Nanette, his wife, and Evie and myself. So there were eight of us, and it was like a lovely little family.
Mm-hmm.
My mother's name was Mary Mills.
Okay.
And when she died, I adopted Mary Mills as my understudy mother, and we were very, very close to them, and for many years, and are still close to their daughters, Hayley Mills, the actress,
yes,
and Juliet Mills, the other actress.
Indeed.
So we still see them all the time, and we're very much family.
Yes, both of the daughters were in Australia only a few years ago. We were in a revival of Noel Coward's Fallen Angels.
Yes, it was directed by a man who's going to direct some things for me. A man called Christopher Renshaw,
mm-hmm.
and he said that they had a lovely time. He knew them all very well, but he was a friend of theirs too. Anyway, Johnny wanted to be in the film, and it ended up being Michael Redgrave as the headmaster of the school.
Mm-hmm.
And Johnny was determined that he was going to get in there somehow, and so he was offered Goodbye, Mr. Chips. And what he did was unique is that he played the young Mr. Chips and the old Mr. Chips from that end. In the other words, when he was old, he was in his 70s,
yes,
and he could still play the young Mr. Chips. Peter O'Toole did it the other way around.
Mm-hmm.
He was the young Mr. Chips, and it's easy to play the older Chips later because of makeup. But Johnny could do both, and he was in his 70s. And in the show, he wore a red jacket that had been given to him by Noel Coward when he was 30 years old, and he could still wear it.
Ah.
He was exactly the same size and shape as he'd been 45 years before.
Yes, yes.
Not many of us can say that.
No. And of course, he was known as a dramatic actor, but I know that he actually made his professional London debut in The 5 o'clock Girl in 1929, one of the Harry Ruby and Bert Kalmar musicals. And of course, he was in the Noel Coward Review Words and Music in 1932, and in Vivian Ellis's Jill Darling in 1934, and even had the hit song I'm on a Seesaw, which made it to records.
Oh, yes, Johnny was a song and dance man. He absolutely was. I mean, at the very end of his life, he played Gus the stage door cat in Cats, in the film that Andrew Lloyd Webber made of the show.
That's right, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So Johnny had a career that went from here to there. He lived to be 96 years old.
A grand
and
age.
And he was in great shape until the end. He was wonderful man.
Yes, and interestingly too, in the stage version of J.B. Priestley's The Good Companions, which had a score by Andre Previn and Johnny Mercer in 1974.
That's right, Indeed. And I think that's probably why Andre was going to write the score of Goodbye, Mr. Chips. But Andre, you know, I always thought, I'd heard the name Andre Previn all my life at that stage, and I thought, God, he must be a wonderful old man, and I looked forward to meeting him. And I found out he was a year older than I was, and I was a kid. And he was a fully qualified musical director at MGM when he was 15 years old.
Extraordinary. Yeah.
And that's why, you know, he made all these wonderful jazz records. He was a fabulous pianist. And at the time I arrived, he proposed me for the Academy, and Hank Mancini seconded me, and that's, I joined the Academy the moment I arrived in Hollywood because of those two. And he was tired. He'd already won 4 Oscars, and he'd been nominated 18 times at the age of 35,
mm-hmm.
and he was ready to move into the classical world, and he did. He went and conducted the Houston Symphony Orchestra, and then came on to London for the London Symphony Orchestra. And then, when he left Hollywood, he said, if you work with anyone, work with Johnny Williams.
Mm-hmm.
And he was known as Johnny Williams then, John.
Yes.
And in the 1970s, he became John Williams. He's now such a classical composer, I call him Giovanni. Giovanni Williams.
And why not? And returning to the 1982 Chichester Festival production of Goodbye, Mr. Chips, I believe that it reverted to the 1938 stage adaptation of James Hilton's original novel as the basis instead of the
no,
updated...
There was another writer involved who sort of worked from that, but it was he had to accommodate the transitions in and out of the songs, so it wasn't just James Hilton, but it worked very well. And the sad thing was, we opened in Chichester. We were the last show of the season down there because it sold out because of Johnny.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
We were all set to transfer to Her Majesty's Theatre again, where John had been, and it was all set, and we were having celebration dinner at Johnny's house, Johnny Mills' house, with Patrick Garland and his wife, Alex. And the phone rang halfway through dinner, and it was Bernie Delfont, mm-hmm. our producer,
yes.
to say, I signed papers today to run a big conglomerate. I forget what the name of it was, sort of Entertainment One or something like that. And as a result, I'm not allowed to produce any shows. Therefore, I've got to stop now, and I cannot move Goodbye, Mr. Chips into London.
Ah.
And there was nothing. There was no. It was too late to replace it, and we had to cancel it. So the celebration dinner became a wake, you know, because of that.
Indeed, yes.
But it was not Bernie's fault. It was just one of those business things that happened. And so that was it. It never really got going again.
Mm-hmm. And approaching the stage adaptation, of course, you wrote additional songs since Catherine reverted to the Victorian spinster instead of musical
comedy. Yes, I wrote several new songs. So I remember one called Take a Chance, where his friend Max, the German teacher, who encourages him to get out of himself and be a little more adventurous and to take chances in life. And that's how he met Catherine as a result. And there were two or three quite nice songs that we added to the score because we didn't have the flexibility of the screen and you know, locations the way we did in the film.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So we had to confine it, and that caused some songs to be dropped and others to be added.
Mm-hmm. And you made Max a singing role in the person of Nigel Stock, who I note also appeared in the 1939 film version too.
That's right, yes. He was very good. He was a lovely person. He was playing a German character, being the German master who taught the German languages at the school.
Mm-hmm. And you also wrote a couple of songs involving the rest of the teaching staff, as well as the schoolboys.
You know, I can't remember. It's all so long ago. But it was great fun, and we had a good time doing the show as well. It wasn't as exciting as the film because of, you know, I went with Herb Ross and his wife Nora. Evie came with us, and we went to Pompeii and all sorts of places on location, or location hunting, really.
Mm, yes.
And it was very exciting to see how a classics master at an English public school would go out and see the world. And we had wonderful times doing it.
Yes, yes. I believe it was the first major motion picture to be filmed on location in Pompeii. I guess they want to guard
the
antiquities.
I can't think of any other one, no, and I didn't know that, but it was certainly a beautiful location to be on.
Mm-hmm. Did you find the locations inspired some of the songs, or had you written most of the score by the time you did the scouting?
It made me go into my Greek mythology and all that sort of thing, as he was a classics master, so he taught Latin and Greek, so I was able to write some songs. I wrote one song called Apollo, and brought a little bit of apparent learnedness into popular songwriting.
Yes, I guess. Did you find it difficult writing for a character who was so suppressed in his emotions, well, at least in the beginning, before he meets Catherine?
No, because I kept the songs on a very small scale. You know, I realised that four notes or five was as much as Peter could cope with.
Mm-hmm.
So I left all the songs, especially when it was recitative as opposed to song. He was comfortable with that, and I did quite a lot of that around him.
Yes, but I guess when John Mills took over for the stage version, you could expand the vocal range a bit more.
Well, strangely enough, it wasn't necessary to do that because they were both the same man. They were classics masters. And the songs were written by then, and they worked, so we left them alone. But Johnny had a couple of new songs for the stage show, and I'd worked through the film songs with him beforehand,
mm-hmm.
and he was perfectly happy and capable of doing all of them without any trouble.
Yes, yes. And you didn't have the luxury of 250 schoolboys as in the film, but I believe they auditioned over 100 boys, and it came down to about 19 for the stage production.
Yes, I guess Patrick was responsible for all that, because, you know, they were in Chichester, the Well, they probably might even have used one or two of the cathedral choir boys, for all I know. You know, there's a lot of music down there, a lot of people, a lot of good singers, because there are lots of public schools down there. Mm-hmm. Downing College is not far away. You know, there are lots of lovely schools, and I'm sure they had no trouble. The boys in the show were very good, and that wasn't a problem, thank God.
Indeed. And rather than an off-stage version, as in the film, you were able to put the school song front and centre, Fill the World with Love, which is quite an inspiring song. And I read somewhere that it's actually been adopted as an actual school song by a number of schools. Is that correct, to your knowledge?
Well, that would be very nice. Actually, the idea for that song, it's not the same idea, but it's a related idea, was my own school song.
Mm-hmm.
Which had a Latin title, which was Paulatim Sed Fermita. That was at University College School in London, where I went before Cambridge. And I love the idea of what it said, and I took the idea of what it said and adapted it to a singable song for the film.
Mm-hmm. Indeed, yes. And I guess it's a sentiment in the song that you yourself live up to and, in fact, have achieved in some degree as a songwriter with the universal appeal of your songs.
Well, I do like that as a school song, and a lot of people have said it, how they like it, and it still reminds me of my old school song, so it's rather a happy connection between the two.
Indeed. And have there been any further plans to remount the stage version of Goodbye, Mr. Chips to date?
No, actually, strangely enough, I was asked in New York when I was over for Charlie and the Chocolate Factory opening this year. I was asked about doing a stage version of it. I said it already exists, and I couldn't see it in the climate of today's stage musicals. I couldn't see it happening.
Mm-hmm.
But somebody over there is very keen on it, and I said I would get around to sending him the script, or talking about the script, when I go back to New York next.
Yes. And then I guess you have the issue as to whether or not they can do convincing English accents.
Well, you know they can't. No, not a prayer. Not a prayer. But when you look at what's going on Broadway now, shows like Hamilton and The Lion King and Wicked and Aladdin, the shows that are sticking to the wall, most of all, are the big, lavish productions.
Yes.
And all those shows are wonderful. You know, they're just terrific. So I don't see Goodbye, Mr. Chips fitting in there myself.
Mm-hmm. Although I guess regional theatre in America stage many productions that don't get to Broadway too.
Well, you know, everything costs so much now. It would be an arm and a leg production.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, what's amazing is that film grosses are like stage grosses today. Hamilton grosses over $3 million a week on Broadway. And it's the Richard Rogers Theatre, and it's not one of the big theatres in New York. It's not a barn. It's a beautiful theatre of a certain size.
Mm-hmm.
But the tickets are selling in the thousands of dollars.
Oh, gosh.
And, you know, people aren't used to that. It's like Lionel Messi, the footballer, getting $1 million a week, you know, the film star's salary for playing a game of football.
Mm-hmm.
It's all so distorted and unreal that you don't know where it will end.
Yes, yes. And I believe some of the hit musicals, they've sort of raised the ticket prices to several hundred dollars for premium seats.
Oh, yes. Yes, absolutely. Well, as I say, Hamilton's in the thousands, the prime seats.
Yeah, extraordinary.
Yeah, I mean, it's a whole new world. Well, work it out, in a 1,500-seat theatre grossing over $3 million, and well over $3 million
mm-hmm.
a week for 8 performances. It's unbelievable.
Indeed.
Anyway, good luck to them.
Indeed. Well, thank you once again, Leslie, for telling us about the backgrounds of Goodbye, Mr. Chips. And next week, you shall be returning to introduce your stage adaptation of Cyrano de Bergerac, with music by Frank Wildhorn. And we'll listen to the 2006 concept recording starring Douglas Sills, Linda Eder, and Rob Evan.
Frank is staying here with us at the moment.
Oh, right.
He just come back from Shanghai with his wife, Takako, and the show opened in Shanghai 3 nights ago, and I'm happy to tell you it's a big hit.
Ah, great.
So that's very nice.
Yes. It might even be an incentive for it to be staged in London, New York, and even Australia eventually.
Oh, yes. But that's why Frank's here. We're talking about it. It was very successful. It was. It's always been my favorite play. I first saw it in Paris in 1946, and I've never let it go ever since then. I've always wanted all my life to do Cyrano, and finally we've got it. Now the thing is to get it in English.
Indeed, yes.
I don't think the Chinese version will work terribly well in London.
No.
Anyway, I'll let you know more next week about it.
Great. Thank you very much, Leslie, and enjoy your time in France with all the sunny weather and with your guest Frank Wildhorn and the success of the show too.
Bless you. Thank you, Rob. Bye-bye.
Bye for now. And I've been speaking with the award-winning composer, lyricist, librettist and screenwriter Leslie Brickus. Well, let's pause now on the program for some community service and sponsorship announcements before returning with tonight's presentation of Goodbye, Mr. Chips, the stage musical. And we shall also listen to selections from the original 1969 film soundtrack recording starring Peter O'Toole and Petula Clark. You're listening to 96.5 Inner FM.